Welcome to Debug, where we grab some drinks and talk about development. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, Guy English. How are you, Guy?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent, thank you. And I am psyched. We have a fantastic guest on the show today, Michael Jurwitz, better known to the Twitterverse as Jury. How are you, Michael?
Hey, guys. Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Do you actually prefer Michael or Jury?
You can just do Jury. It's probably easier for everyone.
Yeah, it's good. People don't know who you are that way.
They're gonna be like, Michael, who's this guy? I thought he was Jury.
I thought guys are having Jury on. This is such a bait and switch.
That's right. He's got a robot head, right?
Yeah, part of like the Daft Punk helmet. It's weird that you wear that like to work.
I know, right? Well, I mean, you have to. Yeah. Why not?
You set expectations. You have to eventually fulfill those expectations.
I'm surprised by how many people are like, "What's that helmet from? Is that?" Do you ride motorcycles? And I just kind of give them the blank stare. It's just like, it's Daft Punk. Come on.
That seems like that would be the worst motorcycle riding helmet you could pick.
Pretty much, right?
There's no way you could see anything coming with that little visor thing going on.
It's the best light cycle helmet, but the worst motorcycle helmet.
Maybe. Right. It's actually kind of crazy. Like those guys, you know, perform in those helmets, and in the middle of the summer when it's totally hot, they've got like apparently water-cooled air conditioning systems in there. They've got to have, you know, little headsets in there so they can actually hear what they're doing. And you know, they've got a crew backstage that can actually, like, control the lighting on the helmets. It's kind of ridiculous.
That's pretty cool.
They're suffering for their art.
I just want one of those. Like, there's some folks on Twitter who have actually, like, done their own homebrew hacked-up helmets and have done great jobs. And it's just like, I totally want one of those.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
It's got to be on Etsy, right?
Going to be on Etsy. It's cooler than a Stormtrooper helmet at this point.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Thanks, George Lucas.
Disney will fix that. They'll own all the things.
Oh, wait. You already did that podcast.
Yeah, too late for that.
So, I guess to kick it
off. Wait, slow down. I got some follow-up. I got some FU I want to do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are we allowed using the term FU, or is Syracuse going to send us a nastygram?
Wait, I'll let him send a nastygram. Okay. That's fine. Not scared of that guy. But we had a couple of like good comments that I wanted to get done before we have a big long chat with the Jury here. So on the forums for the show, Debug, some guy called Maikim, M-A-I-K-M, wrote to us about web objects because we mentioned it on the two previous shows and nobody knew anything about it anymore. Like we're like 15 years out of date on it. So he tells us that there's something called Project Wonder and the sort of web objects community is still going. And if you want to go check it out, it's http://wiki.wocommunity.org. And it's all in Java and they do whatever web objects guys do in 2012. But, you know, it looks pretty neat. So if that interested you, go check it out.
And they have a conference too.
They have a conference in Montreal, yeah, but I didn't managed to find the details on that. But anyway, so apparently it's still going. Jury, I'm sure you spent a lot of time pushing web objects while you were an evangelist at Apple.
Tons of time. Yeah. Let me tell you what, that was the latest and greatest technology when I was there.
Yeah, sure. Great.
I was pretty sure that the only people who were still doing stuff with web objects were still at Apple. I think I can count them on maybe two hands.
That was my understanding too. And apparently when I said that, I've been informed differently at this point.
Well, hey, I mean, I guess it's one of those weird things where it seems like such an old technology, but at the same time, obviously it's good at what it does,
yeah,
you know, to some extent,
exactly,
with how much it's still being used.
Right.
Well, I don't want to sound like a dick, but if you watch Google try to sell phones anytime at all in the last 2 weeks, you can tell that, you know, even with Google technology, having a store that stays up even under nerd pressure is not, you know, it's non-trivial.
Yeah,
it's a hard task. The guys on the store side at Apple do not have an enviable job, I tell you what.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, so the second FU I've got is, this is a crazy name. But anyway, so we were talking about, I was talking to Lauren about rendering smooth paths like they do in Paper and in Penultimate and that kind of thing. Because I had to implement it for the square signing view. And this guy wrote in to tell me that he had a blog post sort of describing how to implement the same kind of thing with Cocos 2D. So Renee, I'll send you that link and we can put it on the page for this episode. Now his name is bananas. But I figured it out. No, it is. It's bananas. But I figured it out. It's not actually bananas. It turns out it's Polish. So I phoned up my friend Gosia to try to teach me how to pronounce his name. And I think it's Krzysztof Zabłocki. Zabłocki.
Yeah.
I'm sure I mangled that. But there's like plenty of Z's in there. And Krzysztof, if you're hearing, I'm trying, buddy. I really am. So he's got – so this link where he describes how to draw these smooth lines is great. If you were interested in that conversation with Lauren et al., I suggest you check it out. Now, the other reason I bring him up is because he's the guy behind Foldify app, which just got a bunch of attention today.
Yeah.
Which is it's a really cool app. Basically, it's got a 3D view. Well, it sort of presents you with a way that you can make cardboard cutouts on your iPad. So you select a shape that you want to do, and then it presents it to you sort of in a split screen. On the left is a 3D rendering of what you'll get when you print it out and cut it up and assemble it. And on the right-hand side is sort of the flattened, unfolded view that'll be printed out on the paper. And you can paint on the unfolded view as if you were just painting on a regular canvas. So you can paint like a face on your little model and all of that kind of stuff. And then so when you print it out, you cut it out, and then you fold it all together, and you get like a little 3D cardboard cutout. And it's an awesome idea. The app looks amazingly well implemented. I've heard nothing but good stuff about it. So just, you know, when that does come out, go check it out. And it should be soon because while I was chatting with him on Twitter last week, I think he said it was in review or very close. So
it should be out a couple days or so after you hear the podcast.
Yeah. So check that out. It's great work, and it's like a awesome idea. So I hope he does well with that.
It's a ton of fun. I spent a lot of last week making little Hulk figures.
Perfect. You've seen this, Jury?
I saw it on it linked a bunch on Twitter today, and it's just I love seeing basically like kind of crazy ideas, things that you wouldn't expect to be like a run of the mill app, and then you see someone actually execute well on it, and it's just like, wow, that's really fun. That's really cool. I never would have thought that I'd be piecing together cardboard figures on my touchscreen iPad, but it's perfect for it, and the app looks like it's really done it well.
Yeah, he's
just works
that. So anyway, I'm excited to play with that. And again, thanks a lot for giving us this awesome link that we can share with people. So let's get into talking to Jury about
about Jury.
Put Jury on the grill.
Whoa, that's a bit much.
So yeah, how did you get involved in development to start with?
It really kind of just dates back to, sort of serious stuff was back in college, but I was the kid where once the Apple IIgs showed up in my house, I was just like doing logo, doing basic, hacking on that thing and just trying to figure out every which way and that it worked. I think my parents figured out pretty early on that I was just going to be spending more time sitting in front of the computer than I was, outside running in the street. And I still did a plenty bit of that, but it was just like, I'd hop out of bed in the morning and boom, my Mac was, what I wanted to be spending time with and hacking around on. And it's really kind of just where it came from. I think I was doing all the crazy, like res edit hacking and things like that, most of us probably cut our teeth on way back in the day. Of course, Rich Siegel will probably say, like, you yunnin. I guess shout out to Rich, by the way. Big update for BB Edit today, which was pretty awesome to see. So
yeah, retinified.
Yeah, I was telling him on Twitter, it's just incredible to see like this single app that has been this constant mainstay throughout the Apple universe for so many years. It's pretty awesome to see.
Yeah, the amount of work that they've put into that over the years, and they keep bringing it forward. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And they've managed to adopt, despite it being a very old code base, they've managed to adopt a lot of new and like continuously relevant technologies while adding features.
Right. So,
yeah, it's an amazing app. Yeah.
I was kind of making this overly complicated metaphor about how like BB Edit development is like, the crashing waves over time. It's just like it keeps moving forward relentlessly, and it's funny because it's an old code base. It's been around for forever. It does awesome stuff. And, so Rich isn't always necessarily the first person on top of things, but like you can always count on that app seeing an update, adding awesome new features, and doing the latest stuff, and always being useful. So it's pretty awesome to see.
And rock solid throughout the whole thing.
Totally. Absolutely.
So you've got a new app out too. Well, a sort of a second iteration of an app that you guys picked up. You guys at Black Pixel picked up recently, which is a Kaleidoscope 2.0.
Exactly.
Can you, like, so what was your role in getting that out? Because you joined Black Pixel 6 months ago, maybe a bit more?
Yeah, about, yeah, 5-6 months ago, roughly speaking. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun to work on. And I joined the team with my focus really being on the product side of stuff. I mean, Black Pixel's been doing tons of client work for a long time and you know, helping big unnamed companies in most cases, you know, ship some pretty great apps.
The best stuff you never know about.
Exactly. That's the best way to think about it. The best stuff you never know about. But on the product side, you know, we've had a few products that we acquired, Kaleidoscope versions, NetNewsWire, and you know, this was a chance for kind of me to come in and really focus on getting the product pipeline moving. And so when I showed up, Kaleidoscope was already being worked on. They were already kind of mid-flight. And, you know, the big thing for me was basically just pairing up with the team really fast, kind of figuring out who was doing what was going on. And then, you know, we had some pretty big course corrections we had to make along the way, but basically setting out the path for getting this thing to, trying to get this thing to GM. And that's everything from, you know, the features we ended up settling on to, you know, trying to make sure that we had some really, really great design for this application, because we were, you know, this is a Sofa app. People are used to, you know, just the awesome design work that the guys at Sofa did. And so we really had a high bar that we wanted to meet.
Well, I think you meant it. You guys did manage to bring a lot of that, very, very polished feel to it. It's great so far.
Thanks.
So you've been there 5-6 months. There's a couple of weeks to just sort of acclimatize and get used to the whole thing. That doesn't give you a lot of time. And you said you had some major course corrections to make. What were they? Like what was going wrong and what was going right?
Well, I think the big thing for us, we knew pretty solidly what the features were going to be. I mean, I think anyone who downloaded Kaleidoscope 1.0 was like, this is a really cool app. Wait. It doesn't do merging, and kind of like put it on the shelf after that. You know, and we had 1.0 had continued to sell for a long time, and I think it's one of the best diffing apps out there. But totally clear to us that it's like, okay, merging is what this thing has to do. That's just the most logical thing. And at the same time, we really found that that folder diffing and folder merging was also a biggie that went hand in hand with that. And so, kind of at a high level, the features are pretty clear, and the engineering team had done a lot of great work kind of bringing that stuff along while also trying to figure out, you know, the headache of like, how is this going to work with sandboxing? On the design side, we had had a lot more churn basically. And, but around the time that I joined, we had some concepts for the app that were really, really pretty far out there. And, one of the things that, that's tough, particularly when you're trying to update an app that already exists, is that, you know, it's totally fine for you to reinvent something when you're reinventing it and you're making it obviously better, right? Like you can look at it and be like, yeah, this is such a better way to do it. And it's harder when it's kind of just reinvention for the sake of putting, you know, your stamp on it more or less.
Was that a fear that you had or like?
It was more of the fact that like the Sofa guys had figured out a lot of really great stuff for just the basic bones of the app and the basic architecture and the way that things were laid out and how they flowed for people. And, you know, some of the designs we had at the time were a pretty radical departure from some of that stuff. And, you know, it wasn't a matter of being afraid of executing on it. It was a matter of really wanting to make sure that, any change that we made, we wanted to do so because we felt that it really improved the situation, you know, not just because it was a matter of like, hey, look, we changed the styling of this thing. You know, I think that's a temptation for a lot of folks whenever you, whether it's, you know, somebody else's code who you're working on or somebody else's designs that you're working on, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to come in here. I'm going to change all this stuff because I could totally make this better. And so for us, we kind of pulled back a bit on that and really wanted to focus on keeping the core experience, the kaleidoscope that people recognized and loved, while also just making it awesome on Lion and Mountain Lion and having it actually feel like it was at home on those OSs. Because, you know, we had reached the point where Kaleidoscope 1, which looked awesome at the time, had finally begun to look like, yeah, this kind of feels like, wait, was this a port from Windows? And what's kind of going on? Just with kind of square tabs at the top, basic window organization, things like that.
It didn't match the modern design language that we were headed to.
Exactly. And Apple's moved so fast on, even on OS X, you know, people seem to forget just how much OS X has evolved in the past 3 years, just even aesthetically. And there was a lot of work there to try to make it feel like it was at home. And for us, you know, we do a lot of work on at Black Pixel. We do a lot of work on iOS apps, and we have people who have a lot of Mac app experience, but it was also just kind of a fun adventure to, you know, be back on the Mac and be trying to build something really great on that platform.
So do you, I imagine you do, but do you dog food Kaleidoscope a lot? Do you use it in your own development?
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of one of the coolest things, at least about working on a developer tool, is that once you kind of get past this, you know, the hump of it being like functional enough, then you're just living on it all day long. And so, you know, the coolest moments for us as a team were, you know, once we had the merging stuff up and running and we had it integrated with Git and we're using it to, you know, resolve conflicts for ourselves. I was working with our designers a lot, and they'd throw 5, 6, 7 different comps for something my way, and I just like drop them all in a Kaleidoscope and start, you know, going through and using the different image diffing tools to, you know, pick out exactly what was different. What did I like? What didn't I like? You know, and it's, that's a really cool feeling, because then you, not only do you get a chance just to better use your product, and that's going to help you ship a better product anyway, but you begin to really see the parts, like the features in your product that need to be better. Because you start seeing how people are actually going to be using it from the start. So that was, yeah, we definitely dog fooded it, and that was some really cool stuff for us.
Did that change your direction in any way? Like, did you sort of go a couple of weeks or a couple of months in and be like, you know what, this feature that we thought was important, we don't use, but we'd really love this other thing that we, you know, maybe put off to a later version or hadn't intended to address?
We didn't have any huge course corrections that we made. We kind of so one of the things that I did after I had been there for about a month basically was sat down with the team and said, like, all right, here's our schedule to get this thing shipped. You know, here are the you know, the following 5 or 6 really big features that have to be there for this release, and then, you know, we're going to be feature complete by this date. We're going to, you know, and then we're going to just basically like converge on the bugs that we're fixing over the next, you know, couple months basically. And the great part about that is that they were able to focus on those features. And as we began to dog food stuff, what we found is that thankfully, like, we had made the right decision about where we had chosen to focus our energies. And it was more of, once we were using stuff, it's all in the details, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, the last 10% is actually like 90% of the work.
Right.
You know, we'd hit these small user experience things, whether it was, you know, the coloring we were using for files, or just how you were actually interacting with stuff, where it's like, okay, we need to tweak this, we need to tweak that, we need to tweak that. And, you know, there's this endless temptation to like keep tweaking. And, it's one of the big things that I've tried to, bring to the process here. And it definitely is the way that Apple works, which is just this idea that, hey, there's always going to be another release. You know, you have to get something that is good and that people are going to like, but there is no such thing as fixing all of the bugs, you know, or all of the features that you want to get into something. At some point, you got to put it out there in front of people, because they're going to run with it. You're going to learn things about how it's being used that you never would have expected. And you're going to, you know, your ideas about features are going to change. And so for us, luckily for our own dog fooding, minimal change on that front, but we've got, you know, now having it out in beta, we've got some really great ideas from folks, you know, just feedback we've gotten from testers. So it's going to be a fun, 2013 as we, keep pushing on this thing.
There's a great old saying that the best managers, like the best editors, like the best teachers, know how to pull or know when to pull the paper away.
Yeah, and it's really true. I mean, I think that's one of the things that people don't realize about how Apple does software development. You know, for all of us who are in the community, we kind of get used to, lampooning Apple 1.0s or seeing kind of these incremental updates and wondering like, okay, well, why haven't they improved these other things? And for software development at Apple, like they take a very patient attitude towards stuff. Like there's usually the core things that they know that a product needs to do just to make it interesting for people in the first place. And then after that, it's kind of like, okay, great. We're going to deliver on those. And you know what? We're going to say no to all of these other things because we just need to get it out there. And as long as we're solving the core problem well enough, then that's going to be enough for us to be able to then, see where this product needs to go. And we might have ideas about where that's going to be, but our customers are going to help inform that even better.
What's your organizational structure in terms of product teams? Do you have like a lead product guy per product, or was that effectively you? Do you have like a lead programmer and a lead designer? How does that all fit together?
Yeah, so we for Kaleidoscope, we really wanted to get some stuff out the door, and so we really kind of focused our efforts on making that happen. So I'm basically the guy who's in charge of the product team at this point. And so I'm the one who's kind of more or less overseeing the folks who are doing product design and product development. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amorphous. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not like, here's Jury's team. It's a little bit looser than that. But fundamentally, Kaleidoscope has got a tech lead. It's got a guy who's basically the design lead on it. And then, I'm basically though in the trenches with just about everyone on a daily basis, just kind of context switching between engineering and design and whatever else kind of needs to be dealt with on the product side. For the other apps that we're working on, we have people who are kind of dedicated to that, dedicated to those apps as well. And again, I'm kind of the consistent point of contact basically for all that stuff, kind of trying to be the maestro more or less.
So if we were to frame it in terms of Michael Lopp's talk at Singleton this year, you would be the dictator?
I don't know if Dan would agree with that, I guess that's more or less the case. Yeah, I'm there at least on a day-to-day basis to basically make the decisions and move people forward.
Right.
And that sounds kind of silly, but having that consistency, I think, is really key.
Right.
I do my best to basically take the stuff that we're doing and make sure that the rest of the company sees it and knows about it.
Right.
And go from there, basically. I guess that's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean that, right. I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean that, it usually pays off to have one person whose job it is to oversee, the whole.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think Michael talked about the fact that, like, at Singleton, that could be one person, that could be two people, the engineer designer pair, whatever. And at least currently that's kind of the role that I'm filling. I think it's been good for the team. We really have made some great progress on stuff, and it's allowed kind of, Daniel and then the rest of the gang to kind of be worrying about bigger picture stuff for, the business and how are things running at a high level, while I'm kind of, the guy who's with the product team on the day-to-day basis. And it's been a good arrangement.
Well, you have to balance both the client work and your own work, right? So if you have, it's not always, all our efforts going into one thing, it's more of a balancing act.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we've got 29 people at the company, and, I wish I had 29 people working on product, but definitely not the case, and 29 would actually probably be way too many for three apps, but I'm much more of a fan of having smaller teams who, are doing more basically. But yeah, we've got, you know, and for us personally, it's been interesting because, you know, the client side of stuff is in many ways what pays the bills, right? You know, it's your chance to work with bigger name folks and make sure that things are moving forward. And for us, while we've been trying to, do more on the product side, it's just been a little bit of a, you know, stealing from Peter to pay Paul while we try to get that, you know, try to get that stuff up and running. And thankfully, you know, Kaleidoscope's been really, really well received. We're really happy with how that's gone. And, you know, we've got a lot of big stuff on the roadmap for 2013. So looking forward to getting there too.
So this was your first major product release, right? Not as from Black Pixel, I mean.
Yeah, correct. I mean, if you rewatch
from the rebooted Black Pixel, because I know that they used to ship a couple of Mac apps, but
yeah, exactly. So there was a few way back in the day, but I think this is probably the first, I'd say the first example of the rebooted Black Pixel trying to make a claim about, like, here's the kind of quality that we want to be known for in the Mac community.
Was some trepidation? Was there, like, going back to that structural thing that we talked about, was there a bit of you wanted to define the product as narrowly and precisely as possible? Was there some sort of internal debate about whether or not you were hitting all of the problems that you wanted to solve? And was there some kind of hesitation to maybe keep it in the oven a little bit longer? Or was that, like, not really a debate? It was sort of well understood that this was what had to happen or what should happen.
No, I think everyone who's worked on product has probably had that debate right before, and Kaleidoscope was definitely no different. That's probably the hardest part in product development, is trying to figure out, like, what is that core set of stuff that we're actually going to ship,
especially for 1.0. That's sort of the first one out of your, like, a well-respected company. You want to make it leave an impression.
And an already known app.
Right.
Yeah, right. That's the biggest thing, is, like, this is not like people don't know what to expect, right? They have high expectations from the start. So, yeah, I mean, that was a big concern for us. And that was kind of one of the things, you know, after I'd been there for about a month or so, that I tried to sit down and you know, spend some time with the engineering team and then our executive team, basically, and just said, like, I think we should focus on the following. And, you know, there it's kind of a guessing game. And I think for any product, this is the case. Like, you need to look at the features that you want to do, and you got to figure out, like, what out of this huge list of stuff that you wish you had the time for, what are the things that people are really going to love, and what are they really going to use right this second? And what can you actually deliver, like, within some time frame? And I think the time frame is probably the biggest key, because a lot of folks start off with the checklist of things they want to do, and next thing you know, you've spent 12 months trying to implement an app, and you're still working on it, right?
You mentioned it before, but I mean, like, Apple is a great example of this. When you look at the new version of iMovie or the new version of Final Cut Pro, or even the iPhone when it first came out, wasn't a feature by feature matchup to existing, you know, Palm phones or BlackBerry phones, but it had a feature set that was so compelling that we just didn't care. You know, we wanted what it offered. And I think that might be what you're talking about, is identifying those things that make it so good that you will have time in future releases to address the rest.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Because, I mean, as someone who's, you know, an expert in the problem space, or you think you know your customers, you're probably thinking, like, 2-3 years down the road about, like, all these cool things that you could do, when there's actually, like, a set of things right in front of you that if you just did today, and if they are if you're picking the right things, like the things that actually have user impact and improve their lives and solve the problem that you're trying to solve for them, you know, they're going to hand you money for that work right then and there. And that's going to give you the ability to be able to, you know, keep delivering them stuff over the long haul. Yeah, it's exactly right.
And it's higher value because you get that money for I don't want to say a less amount of work, because it makes it sound like you're withholding stuff, but you don't have to work for 2 years to get the amount of money. You could work for 1 year to get it.
Right. And fundamentally, like, you're probably able to help fund better development for yourself anyway, right? Like, it's hard when you're just kind of toiling in the desert waiting to actually release something for folks. And yeah, I don't look at it as, like, you're delivering half a product, because that's totally not the case. I think it's I really look at it as taking the time to do it right. You know, if you just throw a bunch of stuff in there, you're not going to end up with something that's really great. And it's actually kind of one of the litmus tests for me is that when we're talking about a feature or we're talking about an idea that we have, if within the first few moments, we just can't even immediately be thinking about how we're going to use that, how that would actually work, you know, work in the application, you know, for a user, almost immediately for me, that's kind of like, okay, well, that's a great idea, but let's think about that later. You know, that's not something we should try to tackle right this second. And hand in hand with that, I think, is something that I'm a big fan of saying this, but it's like deadlines set you free. You know, if you can actually sit down and say, we want to do, you know, we want to deliver this app by this date, that's a great forcing function, because suddenly you find yourself being like, okay, well, we don't got time for the rest of these things, so we're gonna stick those in the next release.
It's enforced focus.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how much did you miss your deadline by?
We actually hit it, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, totally. So we had actually been thinking that we wanted to just GM basically a little bit later in the year, and we looked at kind of where we were at with kind of some private beta testing that we were doing, and we just said, you know, we think we're actually stable enough. Let's go ahead and put this out in front of the world. And basically, you know, this is our first app putting in front of people. So this is an easy way for us to show people what we're working on, and also for ourselves, earn some revenue to be able to, you know, help fund future development. And then also get more bug reports so we could try to make sure that it was, you know, as polished as possible by the time we sort of call it officially GM.
So that sort of brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is sort of the developer tool market is traditionally being, well, I mean, maybe not back in the day, but these days seems like something you don't make much money on. Most of the IDEs are free, you know, with the exception of the Microsoft stuff. But I mean, certainly all of Mac development stuff is free.
Right.
It seems like selling tools to developers is these days a bit of an uphill battle.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think you're wrong. I mean, if you just look at the raw numbers, right, we've, you know, billions of people on the face of the earth and probably hundreds of millions of developers, mm-hmm. you know, if that, right? So, just in terms of the size of audience that you're trying to cater to, there's an immediate, you know, order of magnitude shift.
It's a
right
niche.
There. Yeah, it totally is. It's absolutely a niche. I think you're right. I mean, it's a hard market to sell into. You know, for developers, we've got very high standards. We have very particular ways that we like to work. And particularly on Apple platforms, you know, the tools are free, right? So, which is actually kind of interesting, not to like derail this too much, but it makes the whole app code thing actually particularly interesting just because, you know, here's someone who's actually trying to make a play with, you know, a paid developer mm-hmm. tool as an alternative to something like Xcode. So, I'd be interested to know how they're doing, and I have no idea, but, it's certainly interesting to see nonetheless. I think for us, the big thing that we tried to look at was just the great thing about something like Kaleidoscope or even Versions is that anyone who deals with, you know, source control or anyone who deals with needing to tell the difference between stuff has a potential use for those two apps. And one of the things that we've really tried to do with Kaleidoscope is make it an app that totally kicks ass for developers. And I think it really does. Like for folks, if they go and, you know, use it as their default merge tool or their diff tool, they'll find that it's pretty kick ass. But we also wanted to make sure that there was stuff for, I guess, more of the average user or less of the software developer. You know, the image comparison stuff, thankfully, is great for designers. It's great for, you know, photographers, artists who are trying to tell the difference between stuff. And then folder diffing is just something that I think everyone has a use for at some point.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, crap, what happened to these two directories? Why are they different? Whether it's like a backup you've got or your iTunes folder or, you know, or whatever, right?
And I suppose the counter argument to my own point, or at least sort of the avatar for that is Coda from Panic, which is, you know,
yeah,
clearly a pretty nerdy developer tool. And yet,
yeah, and I think they're actually still one of like a. I think they're still in the top charts on the Mac App Store on the paid list. I want to say.
Well, it's a great app, and they charge real money for it, and it solves real problems. Yep. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's I think that's the key right there is that, you know, if you solve problems for people, they're willing to give you money.
Because their time is more limited than their money is, and if you could save them that time, then they're willing to spend the money.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, look at why do you think there are so many, you know, to-do apps out there or productivity apps, right? Like you're promising people that you might actually help them be more efficient and keep track of their life. Well, oh my gosh, I'll give you cash for that.
I have a theory
on
that, which is, well, it's that everybody. So the good thing about buying a to-do app is that you feel good that you bought it, and it works well. And if you don't keep up with it, and if you don't keep putting your to-dos in it and you don't keep managing it, well, you feel guilty. It's not the app's fault. You let the app
exactly.
down. So if you sell to-do apps, I'm sure there's a certain percentage of your audience, of your customers, that just stop using it and don't bother your support line at all.
Yeah.
So you've got their money and you don't have to support them. And then they'll go buy another to-do app. Because not that they thought anything was wrong with yours, but they'll go and try something else because they want to get organized. And, you know, it's their best intentions. Keep them coming back for more kind of thing.
They're the gym memberships of app development.
That's a great way of putting
it. It's totally true.
And I don't mean to, I'm not besmirching to-do apps or at all.
Yeah.
I'm like the guy with the best of intentions and I constantly forget to keep using my to-do app as I should. And it's not the fault of the app. It's just, I'm disorganized. So. Yeah.
I come back to things every now and again. I'm just like, oh man, now I've got to go through and mark all that stuff that I actually did as done and get everything that I forgot to put in it into it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, and, you know, New Year's is coming up, which is going to be, of course, the traditional, high sales period for to-do apps. Mm-hmm. Right. So,
I mean, I am fortunate that basically, most of my to-dos from work are effectively just bug reports. Right. So I get driven by tickets more than actual to-dos. Which just means my personal life falls completely apart, but that's okay. I'm on top of my work.
Yeah, that's right. At least that's good. So, yeah, I mean, it's funny though. I mean, I think the developer market. You know, I'm happy that we're delivering tools for folks that I think have a broader usability than just Mac developers, you know, or just iOS developers. Although, frankly, even delivering a tool that helps just iOS developers at this point. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about a lot of people. Yeah. Like that developer community is huge. So, you know, again, it's not however many billions of people you can actually reach on the App Store, but it's pretty big.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this, you know, Kaleidoscope works for Mac, iOS. Anybody that buys Coda could probably benefit from the stuff that Kaleidoscope works. Like the problems that Kaleidoscope solves.
Yeah.
So no, I think you've got an interesting, you know, you've got a big enough scope that you've, you know, I think you got a long, prosperous road ahead of you.
I hope so.
I don't know. I'm not sure if we said at the top, but you used to be the tools evangelist for Apple, which probably anybody listening to this hopefully knows.
and if they don't, well, there we go.
Well, shame on them. So you're sort of uniquely positioned to understand the needs, or maybe not all of the needs, but at least the way the developers approach a tool vendor. Has that helped you? Did that help you inform the way that you sort of steer the product? Or was it more driven by internal needs and the dog fooding stuff? Or maybe not. I don't mean to cut you off. Let me just answer your question for you. not so much. Did it help inform the way that you communicated with the outside world, the way that you actually pitched it maybe?
I think my overall experience at Apple probably contributed more to that than just the developer tools position in particular. At the same time, like being the developer tools evangelist, literally have met thousands of developers a year for, you know, 6 years basically. And, you know, so I've seen all the different crazy ways that people work and, you know, have ceased being amazed by the workflows that people come up with. Yeah, I mean, so I think from that perspective, it kind of helped just because it makes it easier to stare at a workflow and kind of quickly answer the question of like, well, no one's going to do it like that. That's not how the process works. But when it came down to kind of the product overall, I think it was more of just the big thing that I think that the product needed at the time was just the experience that I had had at Apple being a part of shipping software, right, basically, and kind of seeing what needed to happen to get that done.
So you were, what, 6 years? Not, you were longer than 6 years at Apple, weren't you?
No, actually, so if I interned at Apple back in 2005. So if we go back that far, that's kind of 7 years, more or less. But yeah, no, just 6 or 7 years there. And then I was a Apple campus sales rep back in the day on my college campus. I spent 3 years doing that. Nice. So I guess total time being an employee or quasi-employee was pretty close to 10 years.
Cool. So you can score me like a free t-shirt?
I wish, right? I wish. They don't give me free stuff anymore.
But so, you know, so over those 6 years where you involved with the community, how did it, I knew it grew.
Yes.
How did it feel? Like, how did it feel from the inside? Like, were you intimidated by the flood? Did it feel like the reins had come off a bit? Was it exhilarating or intimate, like scary? Yeah.
Yeah, kind of all of the above. You know, so I arrived at Apple in time to, you know, be there for a couple years, basically, when it was just like Macs were the only things that, you know, Macs and iPods, right, was basically it. And, you know, I had been a fanboy of the company since I was a kid. And so, you know, I distinctly remembered like the years that things were on death's door. And I was lucky enough to be back there when, you know, the iPod was already basically helping and the Mac was already helping to save the company. And things had like solidly turned around. But yeah, you had this, you know, the developer community was pretty small. It was pretty intimate. Hell, I remember the days where WWDC didn't sell out, right? Or at least it didn't sell out until days before, you know, kind of a thing. There were times back then where you'd actually have people in developer relations like calling up companies doing Mac development being like, hey, you want to buy some WWDC tickets? You know.
They should go back to that.
And
some new,
yeah, I know,
should,
right?
Call
wouldn't that? That's right. Hey, guy, tickets are going to go on sale in 10 minutes. Get yours right now. So, and then the iPhone came out, and there was this incredible attention around Apple, but there, you know, the SDK wasn't there yet, right? So, it was kind of suddenly this onslaught of web development for that brief year with that really, really sweet solution that we all had. So.
Well, just and 30-second aside, you had to grin and bear that whole WWDC. Like, was that tough?
Yeah, yes. I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think tough only because everyone who was at WWDC for the most part was, you know, someone who dealt with compiled software or Cocoa, right? And I think, you know, I think anyone sitting in that audience when, you know, when Steve announced that, which is kind of like,
right,
what?
But you must have got some people coming up to you. And I feel that like a lot of the evangelists sort of unfairly get wailed on. It's a bit of their job.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's kind of, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of the team that's the small collection of folks who actually are visible,
right,
to the outside,
yeah,
world.
They take
so
more heat than they deserve. It's not like it's not like you guys are making the decisions that piss everybody off all the time. So,
yeah, I mean, I definitely over the years and certainly, you know, with that announcement, had some people who like got in our face and were very serious about stuff. And it's just kind of like, I hear you, I understand, please file a book, you know. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the most you can say. And the evangelism team works really, really hard. And so, you know, you have those kind of interactions with folks. And, you know, the next week we're back in Cupertino meeting with, you know, engineering folks and marketing folks, just being like, okay, so 1,000,000,001 people all said, where's the SDK?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you try really hard basically to make sure that we're responsive when you hear common stuff like,
sure,
that. But yeah, it's a position where you either grow a thick skin or you're probably not doing it for long.
Right. Yeah. No, I like I'm amazed how much time you guys spend. Because, I mean, it's not just WWDC. There was a series of tech talks where you would travel all over. And that just seemed exhausting. Yeah. And it's a small team. It's what, maybe 20 people around there?
Oh man, no. It's 7.
Is it that small? I thought there was like support stuff and people behind the scenes I didn't see, but
when you by the time you actually get to tech talks, like there's a lot of support staff who come along for like the actual events, but the Evangelism team itself is 7 people.
Wow.
And way back in the day, or you know, a couple of years ago, it was only 6 people. So, and it's still that size today, which is actually one of the more incredible things is, and one of the hardest things about being at Apple during the explosion of iOS development was just like, oh my gosh, we've gone from, you know, maybe one evangelist per 10,000, like, you know, per like 1,000 Mac developers, maybe, or probably more than that. But, you know, to suddenly being like grossly outnumbered by the number of people doing iOS development. And it was an exercise in trying to figure out how to scale, basically, like how to do more, how to reach more people.
You're a linebacker when the opposing team just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Totally. It's absolutely true.
There's a Sparta joke in there somewhere. Was the small number good or bad? Good in that it was a small enough group that you could capture enough of the spirit of the community that it was easily communicated. Or bad in that it was just totally overwhelming and you couldn't figure out the weed from the chaff.
I think in the days of Mac development, it was a very, very healthy size for just Mac development. It was a very, very healthy size. Mm-hmm. I think at this point with just all the stuff going on with iOS, I think it's a team that needs to grow. You know, I think, so John Galenzi's the director of technology evangelism and, he's fantastic. If you've never seen him give a session, mm-hmm. you know, at a tech talk or WWDC and you're listening, like go try to find one. He's a fantastic presenter. He runs a great team, and I think he really does a good job finding really great people to be in those roles. But there's a lot of need out there for even more of that, you know, outreach, best practices, just management of even just the sheer number of technologies coming out of Apple, you know. But it's sort of the Apple's always been a place that's run things very trim, and that's it's interesting because. You know, when you're there, you kind of look at the situation and you're like, we've got $120 billion in the bank. Can we please get one additional person on this team? But at the same time, like you look at part of what's been Apple's success has been actually more or less keeping smaller teams and organically kind of forcing teams to focus on what matters, mm-hmm. you know, and, so there's kind of a trade-off there. You know, I can certainly see it from both sides. At the same time, I'd love to see that team grow because I think they do great stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, a lot of people sort of point to how much money Apple has in the bank and ask, well, how come there's not just more developers or how come this team is understaffed or how come they don't have this, you know, whatever class in UI kit yet.
Right.
But, I mean, you can't just throw money at all the problems, right?
Like No, you can't. You can't. And it's funny, like having been through a lot of hiring experiences at Apple and seeing engineering teams try to find people, like this, it sounds mind boggling, but, the quality of engineer you really need to do the kind of work that a company like Apple is trying to do is even today, like even with the popularity of things like iOS and Cocoa development, Objective-C and all that is really hard to find.
Yeah, I've heard that from people at Apple, from like engineering teams at Apple that are trying to find people. They have a hard time.
Yeah.
And like a lot of people in school don't necessarily get trained with, like malloc and free is sort of alien to them. And,
right.
Even event loops are like not like a major sort of thing that you get taught in.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I think actually it's kind of it's a little like mini rant I've gone on every now and again. I think a lot of schools do computer science majors a disservice by what they don't teach. Mm-hmm. You know, there's at the same time we've had all these movements in computer science and sort of engineering and all these things to make programming more accessible, whether it's, you know, more stuff going on with Ruby or JavaScript, web development, a lot of more modern languages and things. At the end of the day, like what ends up being the hard part about an engineering team trying to hire someone at a place like Apple is that, you know, remember, like the whole point that Apple does stuff well is that integration between hardware and software and having that be really kick-ass. And in order to actually understand what you need to do to take good advantage of the hardware actually requires like some knowledge of an underlying operating system and how operating systems work. And, oh, gee, there's this thing called memory. I have to manage that. What? You know, and it seems, at least anecdotally, like there are, you know, fewer and fewer people who are getting that kind of really, really low level education. And it's a shame because it really is kind of like the more craftsman necessary side of building these great systems.
Yeah, I mean, we had Lauren on for the first show, Lauren Brichter, and he was saying the same thing. Well, he was saying that he designed Letterpress and all of his UI kit replacement stuff to be true to the underlying hardware and how it worked. And you completely independently, you brought up the craftsman angle, and it's hard to look at anything that Lauren does and not see the craftsmanship behind it. And there's a reason for that, is that he understands the machine and the operating system stack.
It's authentic.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think Daniel Pascoe's got the best way to describe Lauren Brichter is just like he's a warrior priest of software development.
Yes, he's Shaolin.
Totally, totally. It's just like, you know, he's out there, you know, kicking ass and taking names in the field and then, you know, meditating on a hill somewhere and coming up with some beautiful, beautiful design for something.
Probably. So, 6 years in Apple, 6 months out, has your perspective on the community changed since you've been on the outside?
No, not actually at all, as it turns out. Part of that's probably just the fact that I was lucky enough to be in a position that I dealt with the community on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I love the community that we have. It's one of the reasons that I loved being an evangelist, was just working with everyone, you know, even on the days where, you know, the Twitter sphere wasn't so kind. Right. No, I mean, I think it's great to see. I mean, one of the things I love is that particularly in the kind of that like iOS/Mac developer/Twitter sphere, intersection, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of, helping each other out. And I think even as big as the community has gone, there's still in many ways a small community feeling to it, kind of even in a better way than you necessarily see with things like, say, the Rails community. I think the Rails community does great stuff. Don't get me wrong, but, there it's kind of like the community working to help itself. Whereas here it's like the community working to make money for themselves on Apple platforms, right? So, but no, it's been really good, and it's been really interesting just experiencing things from the other side of the fence.
Speaking of the other side of the fence and small community stuff, do you find Radar Web engenders a sense of small friendly community?
Yes, lots of only smiles and ponies and rainbows with Radar Web. So, for the record, I do all of my bug reporting in TextMate and then copy and paste into Radar Web.
Yeah. it's a wise tip. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right from many many lost bug reports of the past.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Radar Web is what it is, right? So it's kind of what we have to live with. And I will totally go on record as saying, like, the thing I miss the most about Apple is radar.app.
Yeah, I've heard internally there's a lot of good stuff there. So.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not, I mean, Radar is not a pretty app. It's an app for a purpose, but by golly, it does what it needs to do. and I miss it horribly.
There's no point asking if that's ever going to change. It's kind of quaint that it doesn't change. I like it's got that old, like, 10.1 sort of pinstripe thing going on.
Stuff like that, I'm sure, will change. I mean, I think people need to understand sort of what Apple as a culture is and isn't willing to move on. I think there's a lot of understanding that the website could be better, the bug filing process could be better, it could be at least a lot easier to kind of stay on top of the communication that comes out of the bug reporting team, etc. You know, but that's usually not overly high on people's lists. Usually what ends up being on it is, you know, I want to see the original of this dupe that I just got sent. And it's just like, you know what? That's never going to happen. Like, it's just not. You know, Apple, particularly, you know, when you're talking about the risk of, you know, okay, great, we're going to show you the original bug, and oh, look, there are product code names in there, and oh, look, there are schedule details in there, and, you know, yeah, you're right, $120 billion in the bank, they could probably employ, you know, a small army of people to scrub that stuff, but, you know, what's the risk-reward there for Apple?
Right, but it's not just Apple stuff. I mean, Microsoft and Adobe and a whole bunch of other people
totally
put, you know, put their information in there that they don't want other people seeing. So
exactly. And I mean, and that's one of the big things about Radar that also folks don't realize is that because it is so closed, it actually does make it a lot easier for, I mean, I know makes me feel easier. It made it easier for me when I was a developer tools evangelist to get people to file bugs, to basically be like, yeah, you know what? Include your sample project because only folks at Apple are going to have access to this anyway.
Right.
And yeah, it's a, you know, there's a can of worms when you go beyond that. And, you know, you're to everyone who says like, yeah, but it's worth it. Like, yeah, you know, it would be great as a third party developer, but this is, you know, this is kind of back to the, I guess, singleton topics, right? Animal husbandry, right? Like, how does this benefit Apple? Well, very minimally. So it's not, you know, it's not something that's likely to hugely change. Now that being said, who knows? Tomorrow it could be entirely different. So, you know, we'll see.
I always go back to that famous Jaws React talk. I think it was 2008 or 2009 when people asked about cut and paste for the millionth time. And he said, you know, it's on the list. I'm not going to tell you how long the list is, but it's on the list. And I mean, there's an opportunity cost to everything. Even Apple has limits in the amount of people and time that they have. And if they're doing one thing, they can't do another.
Right.
And you might want these certain things, but it will come at the cost of some other feature. Nothing is free.
Yeah. I mean, if you fundamentally think about it, like the biggest problem facing Apple today is not Samsung. It's not, you know, patents. It's not, you know, any of this stuff. It's scale.
Right.
It's how do you, you know, how does Apple keep pace with, doing as much business as it's doing, without losing itself in the process and without, you know, and that's not like some sort of, oh, the culture went away kind of thing, but more of just a, yeah, if you throw money at the problem and hire people, that's a great way. That's a great way to end up with, you know, too many heads doing too many things and not enough, you know, not enough knowledge of what's actually going on.
It's exactly what Microsoft did that.
Yeah.
Back late '90s kind of thing, early 2000s. I don't know if you ever read that mini Microsoft blog.
I did.
But he details it pretty. Yeah. I don't know who that guy is, but I can't believe he hasn't been fired yet.
Either that or he's done the world's best job of hiding who he is.
Yeah, or they just don't care in the same way.
I mean, and if anything, like you look at like the staffing changes at an executive level in past few weeks, like I have to fundamentally believe that a lot of that is about making sure that as Apple continues to grow, that basically the executive team is better able to stay on top of everything that's happening. And that's, you know, that means that everyone at that level has to be super good at working together with each other. And any impediment to that is a big deal, you know, for the company as a whole.
Yeah, but the not funnily enough, but sort of to what you were saying, they optimized it by having actually less people rather than more.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the same time, though, like when Steve was still here, like there was Steve,
right.
And he was the effective funnel point for all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So, I think, you know, I think the way that, and you know, I have no inside knowledge here, so this is you know, the wonderful bliss of pure speculation. You know, I believe that the way that Tim wants to run the business is, you know, more of a, you know, group of adults who are working well together and solving things as a team. And, you know, whereas I think Steve had people that he really wanted to rely on, but he was entirely comfortable being the funnel point for a great many decisions.
Right. You get the feeling that, you know, if you have a really loud voice and quasi-loud voices underneath you get drowned out. But when the loud voice is gone, those voices become very loud. And Tim Cook is a different person than Steve Jobs. It makes sense that he would surround himself with a team that complements his strengths and weaknesses, which will be different, obviously, than what Steve Jobs is worth.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the parting words that Steve left with Tim, and that were so touching at the time for all of us who were still at the company was, you know, don't ask yourself what Steve would do, just do what's right. And I think, you know, I think sort of this is the first real evidence of, you know, externally, basically, of Tim making a mark to have the company work well for him, and for how he wants to run it. And I think, you know, I think it's going to be a good thing for the company. You know, Matt Durance had a really funny way of putting this. And I think it's totally apropos, is that, you know, Steve was kind of like the football coach who let the players brawl at practice, mm-hmm. you know, just because then you're going to see really quickly the strong ideas and the strong people who survive. And Steve could basically like work a situation like that and still have it be effective. And I think Tim is approaching it much more as a, you know, a team of peers. And you know, it is going to be a drastically different set of personalities that you want to be working with when you change something like that.
Speaking of like running companies or organizations, the talk you gave at Singleton this year sort of covered that. It covered the how to price your software and how to sort of comport yourself as an entity in the Apple ecosphere. I kind of want to get your advice, because you've seen a lot of companies and a lot of developers and how they approach stuff. Do you have any advice for people listening or people trying to get their feet under them?
Let me count right. The ways. I think to boil it down, really, it's a matter of, and you know, some of this is stuff that I talked about at Singleton. It's just, you know, figure out how you can work well with Apple, and the most important part about that is understanding what's important to Apple. And, you know, both in terms of technology, selling devices, keeping customers happy, figure out how your software intersects with that. You know, if you've got an idea and it's like, I've totally got this great idea, we're going to snarf all this data off a user's phone and then send it over here. And it's just like, no, just stop. Like, you back up to the first sentence there. And then along with that is think really hard about the type of software that you want to write. You know, make sure that you are trying to create software that solves a need for people. And I guess, you know, for all the game developers out there, I'm not trying to disparage that, because, you know, people have a real need for recreation. But I think for a lot of folks who want to survive in this industry, the way that you're going to do that is by writing software that people need, that people come back to, and that makes their life better.
Yeah, avoid the hit-driven business.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's kind of a bit about what I talked about at Singleton too, even about, you know, kind of pricing your app. Like the section on pricing your app had its own sort of coaching on what I think needs to happen there. But, you know, a big part of it is just like, you know, before you even sit down and write a single line of code, make sure that you're entering a space that you want to be entering and that is actually going to be able to pay you at the end of the day. Because there's only going to be so many Twitterifics or tweet bots. You know, the social space is really, really hard to compete in. Games have an incredibly high, you know, high barrier of execution that you have to meet. I think something like letterpress is kind of a brilliant exception mm-hmm. to that. And I mean that more in that, you know, letterpress is a very simple app, but like everything that went into it is actually the hard part and the complicated stuff. Like just thinking of how should this game work? How, you know, and then Lauren going off and doing all the technical implementation for it, making sure that, you know, that it felt balanced, that it was a good idea, that people were sort of, incentivized to keep playing in various ways. You know, those kind of really new game type ideas are hard to come right. by. Everyone's made a Farmville clone, right? But, so think hard about what you're trying to deliver to folks.
So do you have any suggestions? Tell them what to make. Just go tell them what to make.
I can't give away all my app ideas. No, you know, I think, some of the stuff that came out of a lot of the Singleton stuff that I've been looking at, even just in the Mac App Store in particular, is just that, Productivity is a big space. You know, we talked about this earlier in the podcast, but just the idea that, you know, what, you're going to make my life more efficient and solve problems for me? Here, take all my cash, you know. Beyond, you know, so productivity is great. I think a really underserved market is business. And, you know, that sounds kind of drab. And I think a lot of times people look at that and say, what, I'm writing business apps? But like, really, if you kind of look at the software that's tailored for business out there, with some exceptions, like it kind of sucks, or it doesn't really solve problems for people well. And, you know, if you're someone like Omni, who's showing up and doing things like, you know, Omni Graffle, Omni Outliner, or even just trying to write software for a particular vertical, you know, in a business market, businesses want stuff that are going to help their people be more efficient and do stuff better. And they pay for stuff real fast.
Yeah, it's not quite as sexy to work on, but it, you know, it solves real problems and it's got a real market for it.
Exactly. So, you know, I think for everyone out there, you need to, it's fun to try to just do something kind of quick and easy and try to get something out there. And I think for everyone, just writing apps, period, having that experience is so important. Experiencing the kinds of problems that you're going to need to solve with creating your own apps, even if you're just kind of doing it for fun. But at the end of the day, you know, kind of look at solving hard problems. Like at the end of the day, that's why people pay you, is because you're making their life easier. Hopefully, you know.
And that's the right question. Is a lot of times I think people look at the market and see where the gaps are, but they don't ask the question of whether people will pay to fill those gaps or not.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of funny because in the years that I worked as an evangelist, I'd have somebody be like, oh my gosh, there was totally not a Twitter app for people who love gardening. And it was just like, it's like, what? You know, like, wait, okay. You're right. There's not. But do you really think there's a market of people who are going to pay you for that?
Yet there might be no app because there's for a good reason, you know, because no one wants it. Yeah. No one will pay for it.
And I think the other thing people need to do, and this is kind of the hard part, is that sometimes the gaps you see in the market aren't where an app needs to be. You know, sometimes you'll have, you know, in some portion of market, some apps that have kind of solved problems for people, but they haven't really brought it all together in a way that really makes sense, or really kind of brings it under one roof. And, or maybe that they're even just kind of not solving the right problem. And this is something I think that Steve, you know, at a product level was really great at, was kind of taking a step back and saying like, well, wait a second, how can, like, what's really going on here? What do folks really want? Let's build that. And I think there's a lot of different spaces out there where there's room for asking that kind of question.
Which is kind of what Fantastical, I mean, they were doing quite well in the paid app category this week, basically by making an app that, you know, was already built in on the phone and doing a better job, the inverse of Sherlocking.
Totally. I mean, Fantastical from the start has been something where, I mean, even I was surprised how much I wanted to use it when I, you know, started using it on the Mac and then same thing on iOS. And I mean, I remember Michael Simmons coming to me and just being like, we're going to build another way for you to get stuff into your calendar. And I totally looked at him and was just like, you're going to do what? Yeah. You know? And then he showed it to me and I was like, oh.
Yeah, it was the same way.
But yeah, okay. Now,
he told me and then I got the beta. I'm like, I don't know about this. And then as soon as I started typing into it, I'm like, no, this is awesome. It made me use calendar.
Yeah, totally.
Which I didn't used to do. So, yeah.
Right. So I think, and that's a great example, right? Like there's a calendar app that's shipped on every phone and every, you know, computer that Apple's made for forever. And yet here's this utility that came along, and I'm the same way. Like I don't open up calendar. I click on Fantastical on my menu bar and type stuff in or look at my day ahead. And it's great. I mean, I think it's a great example of solving a problem.
There's a hotkey for that. You stinking amateur.
Yeah, I know. I've got too many
key
combinations mapped.
Too many hotkeys.
Lost in a forest of ninjury.
That's right. Between Cloud App and Launch Bar and Fantastical and whatever number of things.
Yeah, you're running out of like stuff to cord with Spacebar, right?
Exactly.
Cool. Well, I'm all out of questions. You got anything smart to say, or are we going to have to get you back on the show?
I'd love to come back on the show at some point for sure. We can talk a little bit about, hopefully, about future apps at that point.
Yeah, I'd like to come back and see how things go after Kaleidoscope and a couple of other things launch.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be really interesting for us. I mean, we're very excited to kind of see what happens. You know, I think app pricing is always something that's really interesting, and it's something that, you know, here I am, I, you know, gave a talk on application pricing at Singleton, and gonna get ready to have fun sort of dealing with that ourselves as we see kind of how
you put your money where your mouth was, literally.
Yeah, no, I mean, we did. We charged what we thought was a reasonable price for an application that really does a lot of stuff. And, you know, I mean, it is kind of funny though. Like we debated this a bunch internally, and it is very different when it's now suddenly like the spotlight on you, and it's like, oh shit, what am I going to try to charge for the application? Right.
We were speaking to Paul Haddad last week, and you know, he released a $20 Mac app for Twitter, and people were outraged.
Yeah,
and
right.
I use that app for, I guess, 16 hours a day, every day for a year. And the thought that someone's outraged at paying what ends up being less than a fraction of a penny for that every day is quasi ludicrous.
Yeah. I mean, there's some really kind of inverted expectations out there, I think, from folks about what things should cost. You know, part of that has just been the direction that things have moved on the App Store. And you know, certainly if you're an iOS developer, like you've probably really felt that because the momentum there is really strong. It's not as strong on the Mac, thank goodness. But, you know, at the end of the day, like good software takes time, and it takes lots of manpower and lots of effort and design and hard thinking and
right. support going forward. I mean, once you sell it, the relationship's not over.
Totally, totally. You know, it's and you know, both for developers as well as users, it's like, don't you want to be able to use this thing for a long time, or do you want a year from now to find out that like your developer couldn't feed his kids, and so now it's no longer available on the store, kind of a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's especially true for higher ticket items, but also like developer tools. Like there was a mass exodus from TextMate.
Yeah.
For a bit there when it looked like TextMate was going to die. And it's still in this weird limbo. But if you compare that to BBEdit, which, you know, just rocked out a Retina version today.
Yeah.
And it's been going on for what? It's like 80 years old, that thing.
Yeah, Rich retweeted some photo somebody had of like a floppy BBEdit 2.5. And it's like copyright, bare bones, you know, 1993. Right. And it's just
it's old as binary.
Yeah, it's just like, oh my God, I don't even want to think about what I was doing in 93. Yeah. I think Rich would probably slap me if I told him so.
No, but that's part of figuring out the value of your software, right? It's that you need to build the longevity and the people who use your tools are going to become accustomed to them, and they're going to build a workflow around it. And interrupting somebody's workflow or forcing them to change it is very costly, and it pisses a lot of people off. So you need to basically plan to be around for the long term.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, I understand people who want low price software. I mean, who doesn't want stuff for less?
I'm sure all our bosses wish they could pay us less.
Yeah, right. You know, so at the same time, it's one of those things where I think for a lot of developers out there, and it's kind of the point that I made at Singleton is just, you know, properly value your software for yourself so that you can stay in this business, because you might actually find that even at a higher price point, you are doing well enough or even better than you would have been doing before. And then you know, even if you have fewer users, like that's not such a horrible thing. Like you're going to have less support costs that you have to deal with, you know, less kind of ongoing stuff. Right. And, you know, it's the goal is not to, I mean, when you're selling any product, the goal is not to make it so that, everyone on the face of the earth can buy or wants to buy your product. Like that's, I mean, like, look at a company like Apple. They're a company that makes a business selling basically boutique products, and the only reason that Apple's become price competitive in our time is just because it's become big enough to actually have really awesome supply contracts.
But they're still way smaller than a lot of their competition, yet their profit share is monumental compared to the same competition.
Yeah, totally, right? Like, I look at those graphs from, you know, from ASIMCO and everything about, like, look at Apple's share of the profit in the handheld industry, right? And it's, you know, Apple gets this. Like, you don't sell things at cost. Like, that's a recipe for going out of business. Yeah, I mean, I think more software developers need to take a hard look at that. And at the same time, like, kind of back to the apps that you choose to build, like, you have to build an app that people are actually going to want to buy and that solves a need. Otherwise, yeah, you know, they're probably not going to give you money for it.
And have your cost structure in line with your business model, unlike very famous News Corp applications that are no longer around.
Come on, you don't have to take a swipe at the Daily.
I have to take a swipe at the Daily.
But we keep coming back to Jerry's Singleton talk, which should be up pretty soon.
Oh, sweet.
We're editing them all, and you got to rearrange the website. We're going to let you see it first in case you want to nix anything that I think it's all pretty good. I don't think you make fun of anybody, you know, except
I don't think so.
You take a cheap shot at Drance, but he had it coming. I imagine.
That's right.
It has been awesome having you on.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, it's a real thrill because you know, sometimes I like talking about the technical stuff, but I think running or figuring out how to plan products and, you know, running a business is sort of the other flip side of the coin that doesn't really get as the attention that it deserves all the time.
Yeah, I think when you suddenly announce that there's going to be a Singleton 3, I'll come back next year and talk about, like, how do you actually plan the development for a product?
That'd be good. Yeah, not a bad talk.
And Guy, I'll give you a 10-minute warning for tickets.
That's
exactly,
right.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, thanks a lot. So where can you find you on the interwebs?
I'm Jury on Twitter. You can also reach me at jury at blackpixel.com, particularly if you're looking to have any apps built for you. And then also, you know, just check us out at blackpixel.com. A lot of information on Kaleidoscope and the stuff that we do that we can actually talk about. But yeah, I'm all over Twitter, so feel free to say hey there.
Great, cool. Thanks a lot, and good luck with Kaleidoscope, and good luck with everything at Black Pixel, and say hi to all my buddies there.
Likewise.
I'll do that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mikey.